Welcome to Coach Your Brains Out, the show that explores learning from the top minds in volleyball and beyond. With your hosts, John Mayer, Billy Allen, Andrew Fuller, and Nils Nielsen.
Today, we're so happy to have back with us the most diligent learner I've ever met, the one, the only, Lorraine Davies. Lorraine, thanks for joining us once again.
Oh, truly, truly my pleasure. My pleasure. So wonderful
It's wonderful to have you. And we got through our technological difficulties. Hopefully we make it through a full podcast. You're in Australia and we're here in California. But I know you got to come out and visit us at LMU in Georgia. And it was your first trip to the U.S. and maybe your first time around volleyball teams and in the gym with volleyball players. What were some of your first impressions?
Truly, and in both universities, the eagerness to learn, which has been my inspiration to come back next year, is absolute eager to learn. There wasn't any, I'm not buying that, or it was just, they'll check that out, and just that eager to learn. And everyone was so kind and welcoming and just could not have been nicer. And not once did I bump up against the I don't know if I believe that, or it was just
playing
like
the piano.
Oh, you would think so.
I'm not sure I understand.
Now I've got Siri on there. Oh, what a time! Oh my goodness. It was just inspirational for me. It truly was. I've talked so much about America to people here and educators, to the degree that the next two schools I'm fully embedding this work, it was I really came back with an attitude of, unless you're going to take this into your own being as teachers and parents, there's absolutely no point in us starting. And thankfully they said, okay, we're scared, but we're up for it. So that's great.
We learned so much from you. Discussing and using all the tactics and all the things we learned from you. And that's why we wanted to have you back on and get into some of the things that we discussed. So I don't know, Billy, you want to start us off?
Yeah, we're going to jump right into some talk on autonomy. So Lorraine, could you start off by defining autonomy for us?
Certainly. What I would like to say first is to just make an alert that autonomy is barely considered or understood, if at all, in our roles as parents, coaches, and teachers. And lack of autonomy is so much behind relationship breakdown, regardless of age, gender, or IQ. So I was really eager to convey that our autonomy, that doesn't concern us. It concerns everyone on this planet. So just to what is autonomy, it can be defined as the ability to make choices according to one's own free will. And that's not attitudinal. That's something that we're hardwired into. So autonomy is related to freedom of choice, and it corresponds to our ability to decide for ourselves based on presented alternatives. So when we just say, this is what you're doing, do it, we can set up a threat response. But when we offer possibilities and options, we set up we then invoke that sense of autonomy. So our need to make choices freely is critical to our mental health and well-being. Hence, I was saying at the start, this applies to everyone, and it's really quite important. So if we feel coerced or even by an internal pressure like guilt or shame or external pressures from other people, our feeling of autonomy is under threat. And I'll be going into that a little bit deeper as we go forward. And sometimes choices are 100% in the hands of a coach, teacher, or a parent, and they're dictated by constraints, particularly in sports. But by offering choices that tie in with constraints, our need to make a choice is satisfied. And I'll just very briefly say, we can easily relate to children reading a story at night. And if it's late, they've had a big day and they're tired and they choose a lengthy book, it's highly likely that a parent will say no. But if we offer a child a choice of three short stories that we've selected, their need for choice is satisfied. So autonomy is achieved even if it's only perceived. And lacking autonomy leads to dissatisfaction and frustration, but lack of purpose. And this is important for adults because that often leads to burnout, and it's presumed to be a result of overwork or lack of support. However, the research shows that the single most significant cause of work burnout is not work overload, but working too long without experiencing our own personal development, which comes with lack of autonomy.
Why would you say we crave autonomy? Can you go more into that? Why we want this?
Okay. I'll open up a little bit more as to the brain connection of this as we move along. But we crave it because not only is it our most basic need, it's innate. We're born with it. We arrive with it. And that in itself is enough to say this is very important. And in another moment, I'll refer to the threat response, but not right now, I'll refer to the reward response. Because when we experience autonomy, we experience the reward response, which is that we're in control, even if it's only perceived, but we're very confident that all's going the way we need it to go. And that releases dopamine. And increased levels of dopamine leads to feelings of satisfaction and pleasure and confidence. And the dopamine reinforcement increases the likelihood that we'll repeat the behavior. So when we as coaches and parents are providing our athletes and kids with that, with autonomy, we know we've got that ongoing buildup of dopamine. And so they repeat the behavior. So it's our need to make choices is crucial for our well-being. And again, research shows and studies confirm that when our need for autonomy is satisfied, making choices, being self-directed, we feel more interested, engaged, and happy. And again, think of dopamine. However, if our need for autonomy is thwarted or actively frustrated, we feel more alienated, helpless, sometimes even hostile, which then inculcates the threat response. So to satisfy our need for autonomy, we need to be offered choices, reasonable choices, and the opportunity for self-direction. So micromanagement is the antithesis of autonomy. So the key to happiness at work for us as adults isn't money, it's greater autonomy.
Lorraine, can you go deeper into what happens when we feel coerced?
Oh, absolutely, because here we really hit the threat response. So the threat response or the reward response, again, it's the overarching organizing principle of our brain. It's all organizing according to that. So we move away from threat and we move towards reward. So we need to create the environment for that. And as I said, our need for autonomy is a powerful innate driver. As with all things innate, it's there to keep us safe, to keep us alive. So imagine feeling forced to do things, even if you wanted to do them, if you weren't being forced to do them. I don't know if I've said that right, but can you guys relate? When someone tells you what to do, we tend to pull away like, no, sure. It's just an inner response. But I want you to know that attitude isn't driving those feelings, and it's often attributed to someone having a bad attitude. Those feelings are associated with being coerced, are brain-driven. And so autonomy is linked to our brain's number one prime directive, and that is to survive. Survival to ensure our genes survive, our ongoing lineage. And that drive is as real today as it was tens of thousands of years ago. So whether a physical threat or a psychological effect, feeling shame, humiliated, we behave in predictable ways throughout the world. And the threat responses we really are quite aware of is fight, flight, freeze, or faint. So when we have our need to make choices, to self-determine is when that's removed, when we're imposed upon by either a person or an authority, we feel less safe and more anxious. And it's not for nothing that the levels of anxiety are going through the roof in the world. So again, being micromanaged or feeling coerced can easily trigger the threat response. So when we're experiencing a lack of control or threat to our sense of agency, our perception of uncertainty, this is feeling not safe, is raised, and that raises our stress levels. I'll go in further a little bit long with what that does to our body and brain. So as teachers and coaches and parents, we need to understand how easily we trigger that threat, and we're not even aware that we're doing it by not providing reasonable choices and self-direction. But by contrast, the perception of greater autonomy increases the feeling of certainty and thus reduces stress. So we adults who want to support learners' need for autonomy must give latitude to make choices. And this is really important, regardless of age, gender, or IQ, and particularly around age. Never too young, never too small.
So what are some studies on autonomy? And can you share some of those? And can you share what the research shows through these studies?
Certainly, there are many studies, and they all say the same thing, that there are studies in many different fields, and they do come out the same way. A particular one that I've spoken about in presentations is by Roden and Langer, and they conducted a study in a nursing home for the elderly on the effects of choice and enhanced personal responsibility. So there were two groups, excuse me, this was in an actual nursing home, and the group that were on level one, they were given these all lived in their own room, and they were given the freedom to make choices, to organise their room in the way they wanted. They had a choice of a plant and however many plants, but they had the responsibility for caring for the plant. So there was no staff making decisions for them, and the resident, they took care of the plant. Everything was done by the resident and not by the staff, except the nursing requirements, clearly. And then in group two, they had no autonomy whatsoever. The staff were fully responsible and made all the choices and decisions on the resident's behalf. And the outcome was that the researchers stated, I'll just read this quote, residents who were given more control over decision-making lived longer and healthier lives than residents in the control group who had everything done for them. See, the choices themselves were less significant. It was the perception of autonomy that mattered. And I applaud that study because there would be many people, I would suggest, would say, oh, that wouldn't work in what we do. But when you consider running a nursing home and the medicines and all those sorts of things, but they clearly identified they had to be giving the residents there, quite elderly, choice and responsibility, and they did much, much better.
Cool. Well, I guess to turn the question towards us and say, how does it apply to what we do? In competition, where it's very stressful, some people would think that being told what to do is something the players would want. But how can autonomy really help in those stressful situations?
Mm-hmm. Well, I'll get to that. And competition certainly is very stressful. But competition is less stressful to the brain than the threat response to the brain. And these are things we've never had to take into account as parents, coaches, and teachers, but we really need to. So again, going back to our primary goal is to predict where and how we can avoid threats and gain rewards, because our brain seeks to make accurate predictions. It has an aversion to uncertainty. So because our brain seeks certainty, it values autonomy. This is the sense of being in control of circumstances, our destiny. And we feel stressed when we perceive a threat or potentially threatening circumstances that we're not able to control. And yet it's just, excuse me, some people want to be told what to do, but my bias is such that people are the end result of not having experienced autonomy, not having developed a sense of agency either in the past or currently. And having learned compliance, this is they've not learned to think, not to contribute, not they've learned not to think, not to contribute, and not to question. They've learned to merely go along with. As life experience has taught them, their input, their thinking, it just wasn't wanted, and it certainly wasn't valued, and definitely was not regarded. And that's not to infer they aren't people going along with having everything being told what to do. That doesn't mean that they're not consistently being triggered into the threat response. I can remember a conversation by email, Billy, that you and I had around this. Do you remember that?
Yeah, as a coach, when your autonomy is taken away.
Yes, with tennis balls, I think it was, if I remember right.
Yeah, in my situation, I had a club director saying every practice he wanted us to have the players do approaches and throw tennis balls over the net to work on wrist snap. It was something for me that I didn't really believe in, and I would never have my players do. And so it felt at odds, I guess, to be going through the motions and having them do this when it wasn't something I agreed with.
And so how did you feel as a coach?
What
did you do with it?
I felt kind of boxed in, and I think we did it one practice, and then when I didn't think it was of any value, I just stopped doing it.
So you ignored it.
Yeah.
And that's a really good one to rest on for a moment, because we assume, because we're the adults talking to teenagers or children, is that they're taking it all in, thinking it's pretty schmicko. But in fact, they could be thinking, "What? This is irrelevant. This has no purpose for me. You're just bossing me." And without any awareness, is that they're not intrigued and in awe of our wisdom. And I think it shows up a lot there with teenagers. Teenagers, it's a crucial, crucial, crucial time in their development that they really step out and be autonomous. And you guys are too young, but I can remember when my children grew into teenagers and I would buy fabulous things for them and to be wondering why they never worn is because they resist so strongly that need to be a carbon copy of an adult. It has to be, this is me, I'm exploring me. And I've heard parents say of their teenagers, "You used to be such a lovely boy or girl," and that's code for compliance, by the way, saying, "You accepted everything I said and everything I chose for you." And it's so important that we feel that pushback and we let them to explore how they need to develop into people, but to give them autonomy. And the competition of sports will not impact on the athletes like the stress on their brain will impact on them.
Lorraine, are there times where a coach wants to be direct and say, "Yeah, this is what you should do"? And when are those times where we can, I guess not in a forceful way, but give direction?
That's a tricky one again. It comes back to, and I've said from day one, John, is that language is power. It's all, the brains are shaped by the language in the environment, because the language creates the threat or the reward response. But that is something that coaches have to be working together. That's not something, because I don't have coach language, but it is something of observing and working together as a group, of identifying language that is so direct and forceful, or language that says, "We're going to try this and we're going to try this. Tell me what you think about it," is still bringing in autonomy. It doesn't mean, as I said, it can just be perceived. It's not to say this is literal, but it's as long as the athletes involved have a sense of their involvement, input, their thinking, which is why I advocate always for athletes to give feedback to a coach or a parent, anybody. It's how it's done. This is why I'd really encourage you to work as a group to identify how you can set that up, how you can do it. We're going to get to directive statements in a little while, about, and that's around language, and maybe that will come up. You'll see that there.
Yeah, no, I think we will. Yeah, definitely with the feedback stuff. I'm glad. I think that was a really valuable clarification. I'm glad you hashed that out a little bit. That makes a lot of sense. So as we go into how the brain responds on a chemical level to autonomy.
Great question. Because it's all happening at a chemical level. So again, to repeat, that the threat or reward response is the overarching principle of the brain. It's involuntary, it's subconscious, it's innate, we're born with it, and we each have that drive. There's no one missing out on that. And again, that organises our brain. So when we lack autonomy, the threat response occurs. And here's the tricky bit. Our brain possesses five times as many threat circuits as reward circuits. And then when we consider the brain is geared for a bias toward negativity to keep us alive, that clearly is readily tipped into the threat response. And just to take a moment, when I'm presenting this information, it really is amazing that we're all surviving in terms of our relationships. And maybe this is where, when we understand this chemical level, the threat reward response, the need for autonomy, our relationships will be more harmonious. Because when we have that threat response, that sets up the stress chemical cortisol, a neurotransmitter, and it's a hormone associated with fight, flight, freeze, or faint response. And because I said before, our ancient system's number one function is our prime directive is to survive, and it will override all else. And again, releasing cortisol into the system is really, really damaging to our health on a very serious level. So a threat, whether actual or perceived, to our sense of fairness, safety, security, reputation, or trust, that activates the threat response. And that, as I was saying before, when you have a group and how you set up these conversations, it's there's a sense of fair play is powerfully important for people to feel. I might not like it, but it's fair or it's reasonable. You'll get greater engagement. But just going to a decrease in autonomy, so when there's an increase in autonomy, that triggers the reward response in the brain. So that releases dopamine. And this is where we want to be, which encourages our brain to work at optimal levels. And you may have found that just as suggesting to an athlete or a coach or a parent, let me give you some feedback, that can trigger the threat response. And it's an involuntary response if a person's having some sense of inadequacy or you're going to tell me bad things, just saying that. So how we're shaping our language is really important. But the more dopamine that we're experiencing, the greater our functioning and our health as well. So it's no more so than if the culture hasn't normalized growth mindset characteristics for all, again, regardless of age, gender, or IQ. So if we're cultivating a culture of growth mindset, there's less of a threat response because our culture suggests any mistake, any feedback is just about taking us to a new level of learning. It's not a criticism or a threat. And more and more, I find teachers are losing their autonomy in teaching practice where an athlete and coaches too, perhaps, when they're forced to implement outmoded 20th century practices that are unable to support learners when there's no understanding of what's happening in the learners' brains and how they function and why they function in particular ways.
So I have a more volleyball specific question, and yeah, it doesn't make sense. Just let me know. So a very common thing in volleyball is when there's a server back at to start the play. That's how every play starts, with a serve. Can you picture that?
Yes, I can.
Okay, so before they serve, very, very typically a coach will give the player a number, and that number means where they're supposed to serve.
Yep.
They'll just show them a number, and they're supposed to serve that part. The number signifies which part of the court they're supposed to serve. It's kind of a quick interaction. So I'm trying to think of a way how could a coach add autonomy to this situation where time is a little bit limited, you're not really able to talk to them, and you want to give them direction on where to put their serve? Any ideas?
Well, it's not about where they're going to serve to, but did you call back the server?
Yes.
Yeah. And again, does that work for you? What would work better for you? Do you see what I mean? It's putting it back to that, no, that's fine. Or, look, could you do this? And then there's autonomy in action.
Okay. So it's how you say it.
Well, and it always comes back to how I say it. You might still repeat exactly the same words, but by taking the athlete into account, you're giving them the learning and the experience of this applies to you so much and we're relying on you. So what works best for you of how I can indicate that to you?
Hmm.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, that sounds good.
Again, we worry a lot as to what to say or how to say it. But if we just ask the person what works for you, we're a long way in front of all ages. And I mean, even little children, what works for you.
The interaction of like holding up a finger to give a serving signal is is pretty quick. But I would think that even with, I guess, the body language of how you do it could influence, like if it was like a strict, like number one, like do this, serve here, versus like more like a raised eyebrow. Can you hit the spot? Does this sound good? Like almost like a question to the server, like a challenge, or like, hey, does this work for you? I think that could even be different.
Yes, because anything that has a question means you're involving another party. Do that is just follow what I say, as opposed to does this whatever for you. They've got a role to play, and that's feeling inclusion. And we know that inclusion or being ostracized, that shows up in the pain area of the brain when the person experiences that. So it's all incredibly important, and we need to be that inclusive and not just barking an instruction.
Cool.
Even though it's not intended that way.
Right. Well, let's move into feedback. Can you give us some examples of productive feedback?
Well, I will. I'd just like to say first off, though, that tell a student the most common ones, which is great job, or this needs work, is a missed opportunity, because telling me what I did great or how to improve my work, where's the information telling me what my next steps are? If I don't know what I did was great, it's just a missed opportunity, because for me, every interaction is having an impact on the learner, their brain, their well-being. So we need to maximize that to make it effective. And because there's so much fluff, we've developed a habit of that. So since learning is a process, productive feedback, it has to be ongoing. And so to be productive, it needs to be on time and in real time. None of this, I'll get back to you later about that. And so when is feedback the wrong time? And that's only ever when it's too late, when it's not in real time. And the optimal time is real time, in order the learner can, or the athlete or anyone, can put it into place immediately. And so it's not hard to see where the good job, awesome, fantastic, there's no feedback on there if that can be implemented. When there's a struggle going on, even though there's been really big effort put in to say, is having something like you're acknowledging what they've done, so in their process. So it's okay, so you didn't do as well as you wanted to. Let's look at this as an opportunity to learn. Again, it takes a little longer than the good job. Or what learning strategies are you using? What skills are you applying? Let's try something different. It's giving them where they can take that next. And that's productive feedback. If there's a lacking of the specific skill and there's a need for improvement, give it a try. We can always fix mistakes once we see where you're getting held up. These things are taking the learner further. So when we're another one, when they've put in really big effort, and it's not just about congratulating on effort, but it's then identifying that, congratulations, you use really great strategies for managing your time, self-regulating, whatever else it might be. And another one I would say is, I want you to remember for a moment how challenging this was when you began. Look how far you've come. So this is at when you see this effort being really applied. However, success without effort is, so you can imagine success with strong effort, good job, or a success without much effort, good job, looks ridiculous when you're saying, it looks like you're putting in much effort. Is this the way you see it? Because then we bring the learner into that conversation, because they know if they're not. If not, what is it that you are doing and how can I help you with new strategies? So it's a way of calling out not much effort is going in, or how can we grow your development in that area, or to make your whatever even better, and then we can put into two processes that they can put in place. So instead of good job, we see your second serve was particularly strong. Wonder if you'd be interested in talking to about your... It's just ways that we're taking them further with every word that comes out of their mouth. Because for me, my guru of feedback is John Hattie, and his criteria is, unless we're telling our learners, how am I doing, answering their innate questions, how am I doing, where am I going, and what are my next steps, it's more likely to end up fluff, being interpreted, you're picking on me, you don't like me, all that kind of thing. But we have to have that effective language in place. And I've shared these with you before about, it's not about being good, but getting better. It's not about proving, but improving. It's not about demonstrating skills, but developing skills. And not performing better than others, but performing better than you did in the past. And I must say, I find it disconcerting for different sports I'll check out on the internet. And the focus really is, we're the best, we're the winners, and it's about performance, not about ongoing and ongoing.
That was part one of our conversation with Lorraine Davies. Join us next week as we talk more about autonomy and feedback.
Welcome to Coach Your Brains Out, the show that explores learning from the top minds in volleyball and beyond. With your hosts, John Mayer, Billy Allen, Andrew Fuller, and Nils Nielsen.
And Lorraine, what about in a situation where maybe someone's down on themselves, or, I don't know, had some tough situations, and you just want to show you care, you want to bring in some positivity? Is there value in that situation to say, good job, to try to cheer them up a little bit?
No. Sorry. But a big focus, you know me well. The good job is just strengthening our neural pathways to keep saying good job when we really need to be providing feedback. The best thing you can do if you want to connect with someone at an empathic level is to identify how they feel with, I can see you feel. I can see that whatever it is has had a big impact and shaken you up a bit. If there are ways that we identify the feeling, then we've got connection. Good job is, it can be like, yeah, big deal, and especially if they're over seven. Sorry, John.
Dang.
Well, I guess kind of on this, we have a question, Lorraine, from Natalie Morgan, LMU assistant coach.
Yep.
She asks, if I want to tell someone that they took a big step and that was good, is it best for the learner for me to say that was a good step? If I don't, it feels like they aren't sure if it was good or not.
Okay. Well, my take on that is, that was a good step, infers, but it isn't specific enough to identify just what that good step was in order that I can repeat it. So what was involved? How did the athlete take a good step? So do you see where it needs more information? Because the possibilities are endless as to what the coach has seen as was a good step. And so personally, if I was the athlete, I'd be well pleased if I've done something that prompted being told that was a good step, but I would need to have it labelled, learn to have it identified what was good about it, and I would want to know if it was something that I've really been trying at and not just fluked it for my first time I ever gave it a go. But most importantly, I would want it, because it's clearly pleased my coach, which means I've done well and I'm getting better, I'm improving, I would want to repeat my action. So hence, I would need to have the skill identified in order for me to repeat the good step. So was the good step related to a non-cognitive skill, for instance, with persistence or focus or taking a reasonable risk, or was it a volleyball skill? So did taking my big step take me out of my comfort zone? Did I draw on courage? Did I step up into leadership? Or was I attempting a new skill? All these questions need to be answered by the feedback we give. And also, just as a little careful one, good is a value judgment, and it's well intended, but a value judgment nonetheless. And we use words like good without anything around it. We can equally be perceived as that we have the propensity then to use a value judgment of not good enough. We're growing neural pathways with whether we want to or not. So that's where we have to practice so that we get that. Remember that animation with what we're focusing on expands, and what the other one, the Hebbian law of what you focus on, what you fire together, wire together, and what no longer fires together will unwire. So that's where we need to practice what we want to say so we can say it deliberately, because we've got years of good jobs and great and awesome in us.
Right. Yeah, I've been working on it a lot since you've been gone. I still got a lot of pathways to grow. So another thing that you talk to us about is, and I think it's very common, and I'm still working on this, but when I give feedback, I'll start the statement with I. Uh-huh. I saw you improve at this. I saw you working at this. Can you talk about the harm or value of?
Okay. You just example then is I saw you about, you're telling the person, the athlete, who's looking to learn from you to improve, you're telling them what you've just observed. But you're not talking about them. You're talking about what you've been observing, not what they did, and the processes they've been putting on. And it's intended to be so kind. I'm so proud of you. I saw, and I like the way you. And again, we're only coming back to ourselves. And I did this in a class just very recently, and the lady had picked up her pen, and I said, oh, I like the way you picked up your pen. And she had a big smile come all over her face. And so it just says how set up we are to hear nice things about it, even if they're completely empty. And so I asked her, what have I told you? Is that I like how you picked up a pen. It was completely unrelated to anything. And it's that I like is well intended, but it does cause a lot of damage. So it can confer that I'm watching you, not as in a very positive way. It's I'm watching you, I'm seeing you. But it says, it can say, I'm watching, or I saw how you're learning to help, watching you learn and how to help you grow and take you to the next level. That's appropriate for our observation, because invariably we can let ourselves down and others down when we're observing, or when we fail, when we're distracted, when we're not present. Being present is everything. And off track a bit, but we see that at playgrounds where children are just calling out, Mom, look, Dad, look, and all that. And we're usually talking to someone, or even worse, on our iPhone. So I saw is reaffirming that we need what we're seeing.
What about the situation of, you know, you're with your player and it feels like it's you and them. So you say, we need to work on this.
Okay. It's again, it all comes down to the we statements. So if you were saying that we need to work on that, and you know, and there's a good culture, a good rapport, we can usually mean, well, I'm not talking about me, I'm talking about you. Whereas if it's that kind of rapport and understanding that it conveys, the language conveys, I'm here to work with you and help you, so we'll work on this together. That's a powerful statement of support, and you're not expected to do this alone. That's my job to help you as the coach, or to work with you as the coach. The negativity or the absolving oneself to direct it onto others, that will trigger the threat response quite quickly. So for instance, a you statement, it could be, you didn't do your job, you messed up. So a you statement is better. You need to be really proud of what you've achieved is a you statement. But if it's a you statement twisted to, you didn't do your job and you've messed up, well, maybe they did and maybe they didn't, but it's an accusation and it's not necessarily a fact. Failing to identify roles played and things like that. I'm really concerned. I get very, very self-conscious that I can sound nitpicking, but I promise you, I do observations in classrooms, and it's easy to see how the rise and fall of the learning and the well-being in the classroom rises and falls according to the language being used. It's quite profound.
Yeah, and I can relate to what you said with the we statements, because I feel like that's my passive-aggressive way to get my partner to work on something. I say, hey, we need to work on blocking or something.
And are you working, playing alongside of them doing that blocking?
No, I'm not. That's mostly their job.
No, he's never blocking.
Funny about that.
Yeah. Lorraine, how does the brain respond to I or we statements versus informative statements? And I guess just to refresh the listeners' memory, can you go over briefly what informative statements are?
An informative statement is free of judgments for a start. You're giving a person information. As a directive statement is language of command. And so, for instance, you might say, sit there, stand up, pick that up. For children, we say, get in the car. They're all directive statements. And again, they will invoke a threat response. We give a lot to children, but a lot not limited to children. I've certainly heard adults speak to each other in the same way. So whereas an informative statement is invitational. It doesn't sound bossy, whereas a directive statement does. And it can feel really, again, with changing our prey language, it can feel incredibly awkward when we're reframing directive statements with an informative statement. So, again, useful to practice to grow neural pathways. So what I saw going on in the gym, for instance, when I was there, was someone would yell out, pick up the balls. But that's a directive. An informative statement reframe is, I can see balls over there. Now, that may sound so trivial, but when we're doing that, we're giving the athlete, they get to do their own thinking, their own decisions about their own behavior. Because directive, it can almost have a twist on it of, why haven't you picked that ball up? But if an athlete, if he hears there's balls over there, oh, right, I'll go and get them. Yeah, I'm close, I can do that. Do you see the difference? It's very flimsy, but it's a very strong difference of when you're telling someone what to do, where they can make decisions about, I'll go and get that, as opposed to, oh, heck, I'm in trouble because I didn't pick it up. So the ultimate weakness of relying on directive statements is that over time they need to be escalated in intensity. So our role is that we speak informatively and leave a space in which our learners' thinking can take place. And I've said this before, in the US, when we tell students or athletes or our children what to do, we give them only two choices. To do as told, which means to acquiesce, or not do as told, which means to rebel. And again, both situations induce the threat response, releasing public enemy number one, cortisol. We command or we guide. And even Daniel Pink says, control leads to compliance, autonomy leads to engagement.
I'm wondering, with the really high performing, really effective teachers that you've observed, what percentage of their feedback is an informative statement?
Oh, heck, there's one school I'm particularly thinking about. And, oh, golly, I would say 75 to 80%. And invariably, when it's not, it's been when we've had a new intake of teachers. And I don't mean, you know, the staff replacement, but the newer teachers have still got that highly developed, you say these nice things, or you give direction, or you tell children what to do. And they're very keen to get on board, and they're very embarrassed when there's someone around, oh, sorry, I didn't mean to say that. But certainly the numbers is very, very high. But again, the school I'm thinking of, they began this journey back in 2014, so they've really been working it. And it's also the culture there. For instance, nothing can bring this up smarter or faster than imposter syndrome. And to deal with that, they created an after-school time, because the school understands that any time we can be triggered into imposter syndrome. So at the weekly meetings, it's just understood there's a crucible of safety, openness and trust to name feelings and responses to particular scenarios, no matter how embarrassing. And that unites the staff and reinforces their sense of belonging and connection. But again, it's from that safety to get it wrong. And it just, oh, it's like telling a child how wonderful they've wiped the bench, and they're like, I can wipe other things. And when teachers are given and parents opportunities to, it's perfectly normal and okay. They just want to improve so much deeper and quicker. But that's it. Nothing embarrasses people more when they realise Lorraine Davies is standing near them and they've been saying all the good jobs and or telling kids what to do. But I certainly... Well,
it's a really high percentage. Yeah. I mean, 75%. I'd love to strive to be able to be that informative.
Yes. The informative... Oh, golly. It's either about asking... Yeah, when you said that, so much of the conversation is about bringing questions to the students for their thinking, not so much telling them. That's a really big part of it, so the children are encouraged to think and come up with some other alternatives or some of their own answers, but certainly informative. I can't even imagine, actually, as I'm thinking. I'll just say very briefly, if I may, there was actually a learning took place with this, and it actually involved my granddaughter. And the teacher, my granddaughter was standing next to me, and the teacher said, Hannah, I want you to, and I want you to do this, and then I want you to do that, and then I want you to do this. And Hannah turned on her heel to go and do exactly that. But knowing Hannah, I said, Hannah, can you tell me what you've just been asked to do? And she went to speak, but she had nothing. And that was a really big, really big learning for the teachers, and it went through the school. Just telling isn't enough. There was hearing, but no understanding. And so we need to clarify what's been understood, and it's got to be safe for a student to be able to say, I don't know. And so that when we tell, when give that instruction, we don't know that it's been processed or understood, and especially when there's three directions given at once, directives rather, given at once. We're in such a rush. So the informative of when you, then we can, then that can be attended to. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
that applies to our own, particularly our own children.
So a lot of the feedback that athletes and students hear is from each other. So I'm wondering how you teach athletes or students to give productive peer feedback.
Well, first of all, peer feedback is absolutely, absolutely brilliant. I highly, highly recommend it. But I hasten to say it needs to be explicitly taught, because feedback has to be kind, specific, and helpful. So it requires explicit teaching. I highly, highly, highly recommend you begin, or anyone begin, looking at the most amazingly incredible Ron Berger, B-E-R-G-E-R, and his YouTube videos or his EL education videos. And they have very specific YouTube clips on doing just that. But with peer learning, again, this happens at a really top school I'm thinking of. Peer feedback, it's just normal for kids in the class and to the teacher to say, can you give me some feedback on this? And again, as they've been taught about that it has to be kind, specific, and helpful. And they really thrive on that. And being with peers, I believe it has a much more powerful impact, because there's such a sense of trust, and it's just taken as a fact, as opposed to, I've heard kids say to some teachers, oh, you're just being mean to me, because it's too painful to hear that there's more work required. It's not something we should launch into with, I just want you to start giving each other peer, I want you to give each other peer feedback. It's critical, critical for growth, but just needs to be taught really well, because we can easily get it wrong. There are rules around that.
I strongly recommend people watch that video. It's such a great, great video.
With the Austin's butterfly. I like to point out in that video, because it can be easily missed, his artwork went from what I would have thought was adorable for a five-year-old as a grandmother, but with the peer feedback, it elevated to a level of a piece of masterpiece drawing, and yet the only way it got to that level was from the feedback from peers. There wasn't any adult intervention or commentary anywhere.
Lorraine, I have a question from a listener. Aaron Mansfield asks, in high-performing cultures that you have been around, what are some things you have noticed in the way the members of the group interact or communicate with one another?
Okay. So I think I'd like to share with you an experience I had years ago, particularly that examples culture at a very high level. And when I came to the attention of Mindset Works, and that's the company co-founded by Professor Carol Dweck from Stanford, the originator of all this work, I came to their attention. And at the time, David Schweitzer was CEO. He's now with Google. And David asked me if I would mind sending him my work. And I immediately fell into imposter syndrome. And thankfully, although not consciously, expressed out loud, what if my work is crap? Because this is Mindset Works. This is Carol's backyard. And David laughed a little and said these magical words. And he said, yeah, it might be crap, but how great to be in a place where you can receive feedback to improve. And I just spontaneously burst into tears. I was stunned about his response, that being totally crap is simply a learning opportunity. And as I cried, David said, yeah, that's what it's like when working in a growth mindset culture. So there was no pep talk, no fluff, no reassuring, oh no, I'm sure it'll be wonderful. It was a culture of that where honest feedback was just how it was. And I was later invited to be an affiliated partner with Mindset Works. So that was just dipping your toe in how we can create a culture where feedback joins people together, and there's no value judgments. You're just hearing how it is, and it's kind, specific, and helpful. It was amazing. I don't know if that explains that, but that to me is a culture to aspire to. When there's not that reassurance of, oh no, it's lovely.
Yeah, I like that story.
Mm-hmm.
Aaron has a second question. There are many non-cognitive skills that you can tie praise to. Have you noticed any non-cognitive skills that stand out that lead to more effective learning or performance than others?
Oh, I can actually do better than that. But what I would like to focus on the question was that the focus was on being effective rather than efficient. And that is so admirable because there's a huge difference. And more I see this world turning to, oh, it's efficient, it's quick, it's easy, but it's far less effective. So that's a great focus to have. I'll just tell you about the Dunedin study. It's now in its 40th year and ongoing. Began with these very, very young children and still going. And they confirm that self-regulation is the number one non-cognitive skill for personal, academic, and professional success. So it's crucial that if we observe even the slightest moment of an athlete student in coaching, in their self-regulating, it's crucial that we name in our process praise or feedback in order that they learn that self-regulation exists within them, even if in small amounts, that they can develop that self-regulation across many things. Because too often those we teach or coach are unaware that they possess any non-cognitive skills. And so when we can name the skills that we're seeing, but that's the trick of it, we have to observe what we're seeing. And it could be a whole myriad of different non-cognitive skills, but the most effective is for self-regulation, self-discipline, self-management, but self-regulation is usually what it's referred to. And so to name that, name the skill, to name the non-cognitive skill, to name the process, and as we have to have observed that action. So, for instance, another one for building great culture within the organisation, school, gym, anywhere, is you showed a lot of compassion and empathy for Chris when you comforted her. Oh, I have empathy and compassion. You imagine someone who's been told they're thoughtless and don't care or whatever. No, I've been told I've got empathy and compassion. We need to name these non-cognitive skills so we can see them, and when we see them, to feed back that that's what we're seeing. But just in terms of how much they're found in this Dunedin study, even if people are overseas, people in New Zealand where it's based, will fly to them. If a person's in jail, they'll go to the jail to interview them. It is kept so incredibly strong, tight, and professional that they want to see it through. But it clearly, head and shoulders, self-regulation is the strongest non-cognitive skill that will guarantee success personally and professionally, which I think is pretty powerful.
It's always a pleasure picking your brain. I know you mentioned that some of this might sound nitpicky, but just how important it is because language is so powerful. Can you share with the listeners? I remember as we were talking when you were in California, we were kind of saying, oh, what should I do this and what should I do here? And you said that should is actually kind of a buzzword or a no-no. Can you explain why?
No, should infers you've done something wrong. Mm-hmm. And I should have picked that up or I should have put that down as opposed to could. Could's a word of possibilities. Yeah, I might put it down or I might pick it up or I might do that. But if you should have put that over there, there was only one way and I've really fluffed it. So it should induce a shame. And again, I always, my first thought is, oh, I probably sound nitpicky, but it's true. It infers you've stuffed up, you've done it wrong, as opposed to it was just a possibility. You could have done it that way or you could have done it this way.
It's all come full circle. It's the perception of autonomy again, huh?
Always. Always, 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 always. And look, just one thing I'd like to say, and I've said taught this before, a sense of autonomy is not a nice to have. It's critical, critical for our mental health and well-being. It really is.
Well, it's something we're going to continue to be aware of, and you've given us a lot more to go out and practice, because I know a lot of this is changing habits, and we need to bring awareness to the areas where we don't have autonomy, or we're using I statements or saying good job. So we'll get to work, and we'll work on getting better, and then we'll follow up again soon, and can't wait to have you visit us again in May.
Well, I really like what you're saying, John, and that could sound like will make me happy. But what I'm saying is that I really encourage, and this is, again, the culture comes into it, of when we work together as a team, we're supporting each other. Just as the school I spoke about, where it's understood we're just bumbling and stumbling around and we're making mistakes and we're feeling inadequate, but we support each other to strengthen each other to move forward. So anything that you're doing is when it's shared with those around you, those from the athletes to your children, to your partners, to your peers and colleagues, it's so important that we do it as a group, because we normalize it to the group, not just something weird about him or her.
It's a great message to close with. Thanks, Lorraine.
Thanks, Lorraine.
Oh, thank you. Thank you, guys. I really love speaking with you. I really do. I do a bit of self-censoring of, oh, gosh, what does that sound like? But I love talking with you.
No, we love.
I've lost you.
John cut out, but he's saying all kinds of praise words.
Oh, bless you, bless you, bless you, bless you.
I didn't say good job, though.
I thank you. I bless you, John. Bless you, Bill.
All right, good night, guys.
I look forward to seeing you.